alcoholic.
It's an honor to be asked to do this, even though it's like, oh my God. I met Kathy actually here at the Howell Place, which I rarely come here, but used to come here many, many years ago when Paul told his story here, actually about 3 years ago. And she got her her chip after the meeting, 37th, 38th chip. And I was impressed with that because I'm rather a picky alcoholic, you know. And I was rather broken at the time with 20 years in this program. And I got her number not knowing I was going to ask her to be my sponsor. And right away, she became my sponsor. And I asked one of our sisters here. She's got several daughters here tonight. And I said, what do I say about her? And she said, she's a great mom, you know. And she is a great mom, a great friend, a great mentor. But what Kathy really is for me is right away we met and at Hillside. And I told her all the garbage about Paula in 20 years. And then from the growing up years and then 20 years of sobriety. And she held my hand, and she's walked with me since then, and that's what AA sponsorship is about. It's walking with us in the good times and in the tough times and saying, I'm a fan of you, and I'll help walk with you through this, and that she has done. She knows the AA principles in the program from the old school AA, which is where I'm from, and it means a lot for this alcoholic, and she honors the tradition in a home group. That's why I belong to the same home group as my sponsor. And I think it's important. I think it's important for those old timers to pass that along. I try to do that. And if you haven't heard her story, you're in for a treat. She's a classy lady with lots of integrity, elegant. She's a world traveler, which I yearn to be more of. And I couldn't have found a better sponsor. And God had a hand in this, and thank you for being here for me. And with that, Kathy S.
Wasn't that nice? I'm Kathy, I'm an alcoholic. Okay. And I was kind of focusing on the classy and elegant. It wasn't always like that. You made it. I'm going to tell you what it was like. Man, this podium is high. What it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I'm from Boston, Catholic alcoholic. They call us CIAs, Catholic Irish Alcoholic in Boston. My sobriety date is longer than some of you people have been born, I know. It's July 10th, 1977. And I haven't had to pick up another drink since that date. And I often say that fear kept me sober for a long time because I was really afraid that if I didn't do what you told me to do, that I'd get struck drunk. You know, I didn't know how that was going to happen, but I would just wake up and be drunk. So but let me tell you a little bit about what it was like. I started drinking when I was 14, which seems to be kind of a rite of passage, you know. I bet you there's a lot of people in this room that started drinking at 14. And I'm from Boston, and it was in the winter, and so, and I grew up in the city, so we drank in a hallway to keep warm. And we were drinking. A lot of people haven't heard of Silver Satin wine down here, but it's the equivalent of Mad Dog 2020. Anybody ever hear of that one? Okay, it's really good on the stomach. So, So, anyway, I drank that night with the other kids, and I got really drunk, and I went home, and I don't know if this has happened to any of you either, but I laid down in my bed and everything was spinning. The room was spinning, spinning, spinning. And I was throwing up, throwing up, throwing up. So the next morning, my mother came in and she said, "This smells like a brewery in here. Have you been drinking?" I said, "No." And so she had a cure for me. And the cure was that I would get up and I would clean the house and I would be so sick that I would never drink again. So that didn't work. But what did work is the comfort level I got from drinking. You know, there was Clancy says when he took that first drink of vodka, it was like kaboom. And he said, everybody doesn't feel that way when they take their first drink. But that's kind of what alcohol did for me. It made me comfortable within my own skin. So I was, well, they used to call it a periodic, but I drank more on the weekends because I couldn't get money or booze through the rest, you know, through the week, only on the weekend. So I didn't have much of a choice. And every time I would get in a little bit of trouble of some sort, some kind of jackpot, I would quit drinking for a while, for a short while. And so I drank all through my teen years, and I didn't get in a whole lot of trouble. But then I met him. You know who he is, right? We all know who he or she is. And I was 19, and he was a singer in a band. Man, he was so cool. He was just so cool, and all the girls wanted him. And that's reason enough right there to marry him, right? But anyway, my mother liked him, and that was real important. So anyway, he was an alcoholic, and I know he was an alcoholic because we were married about 2 weeks, and I took him to the hospital with the DTs, and the doctor said to me, do you know what's wrong with him? And I'm like, I think so. And he said, your husband's an alcoholic. I was appalled. You know, I mean, I married an alcoholic. But my father was an alcoholic. I should back up just a little. My father was a periodic alcoholic, and my mother wasn't an alcoholic. And I always tell this when I tell my story because to me it's interesting. It may mean nothing to you. But my mother came from a family of 7 kids, none of which were alcoholic, but all married alcoholics. Isn't that weird? So my mother married an alcoholic, and he was a periodic, and he drank like twice a year, and it was always memorable. He would drink for a week, and then he'd taper off and sober up for a week, and then he'd be back to normal, like he never had a drink before. I like to tell this story too because I think it's funny. I grew up where my mother nailed the Christmas tree to the wall every year. So I grew up nailing the Christmas tree to the wall because there must be some reason for it. She did it. So when I got sober, maybe my sponsor said to me, why do you nail your Christmas tree to the wall? And I thought, you're supposed to. So I said to my mother, why did you nail the Christmas tree to the wall? And she says, because your father got drunk every year and fell into it and knocked it over. So, like, you know, so I don't have to nail my Christmas tree to the wall anymore. I let that one go. But and my father did a lot of, you know, interesting things, I think, that were memorable. For example, we woke up one morning and the basement was full of ducks. And my mother got up in the morning and said, where the hell did you get all those ducks? Well, he got them in a blackout. He didn't know, but, you know, we had a lot of ducks. But anyway, then I remember my father, you know, the part of alcoholism where the rage, and I'll get into that because I certainly had my experience with that. But my father was drunk and having a tantrum and, you know, the French doors. And he was systematically punching every one of the doors out. And my mother was screaming, everybody was going crazy. You know how it is in alcoholic homes. And my grandmother came in, she was 4'11", his mother. And she said, I don't know if you've ever heard this word, but she said, you scald you. And my father just went like this and stopped doing that. But so that's just a little bit of history of my household. My personal drinking career, once I married this wonderful man, I could really drink the way I wanted to then, you know, and I was very fortunate that I always had people around me that would take care of me when I got drunk. And I said that to Mary Walsh one time, and we were at Hillside, and there's an Al-Anon meeting and there's the AA meeting, and I said, you know, Mary, I always had people that were driving me home and taking care of me. She said, yeah, and they were all right in there. So I never forgot that. That was true. Who else are we going to hang with, right? So I moved to California. Well, I moved back and forth to California a lot. But I moved to California with this guy, and he was going to be like a big star and all that. And it didn't quite work out that way. You know, he didn't become a big star. And he decided to leave California, move back to Boston. And I decided to stay in California because it was in the 60s. And it wasn't very far from Sunset Strip. And so I'm of that generation, you know, where there was a lot of just drugs and rock and roll. My husband's here. So there wasn't that other thing. So anyway, there I was in my little, you know, leather and hats and trekking on down Sunset Boulevard saying, peace. Far out, cool. That was pretty much the extent of the conversation. And, you know, everybody would, you know, this is Alcoholics Anonymous, but I'm not going to talk about drugs, but I did learn how to live through modern chemistry in California. And one of the things was, if you sat around smoking a little pot, that was the conversation there. Pretty much it was far out. No matter what anyone said, far out, you know, didn't matter. I mean, that was enough. It was all inclusive there. So anyway, I got pregnant, and I decided that I wasn't going to drink while I was pregnant because I wanted to have this. I got pregnant by my husband, by the way, but but just make that clear. But anyway, I didn't want to lose this baby. I really wanted to have this child. So I stopped drinking for the 9 months that I was pregnant. You're not supposed to drink while you're pregnant, right? But anyway, the day she was born and I got out of the hospital, the very first thing I wanted to do was drink because I deserved it. I waited 9 months and I didn't drink. I did the right thing. It's funny how when we're practicing, doing the right thing is like we want to attaboy, you know, and we're just supposed to do the right thing. You know, we're just supposed to do it. But so anyway, this is one of my less proud moments. I came home from the hospital with the baby dying to get out. And I'm in my mother's entryway. And well, I went out with my husband. I left the baby with my mom. And I come home and I am so drunk that I can't walk. And my mother's saying, you're not going to take that baby home. And I said, oh, yeah, I am. I am taking my baby home. And there we are, pulling this baby. And anyway, fortunately, she won and I stayed there. But I then had a pretty bad history of what transpired on a go-forward basis. I kind of lost control of my drinking, how much I drank, how often I drank. And I would get in a lot of problems. One in particular, it was St. Patrick's Day, and I was living in California. I am Irish. So I was out celebrating at Kelly's, and they put the K backwards. You know, Ed W., he drank. He's the only person I've ever met here that drank in the same bar that I did in California. I instantly wanted to be friends with him because, you know, camaraderie. But anyway, I'm standing. I go to the ladies' room. I go with all these people to this bar, and I go to the ladies' room. And you know how you go to the ladies' room and you make friends? You know, you just kind of hang out there, and you talk. And you share whatever you have. And so I come out of the ladies' room, and apparently I was in there for a really long time, but I was socializing. So I come out of the ladies' room, and I can't find my people. I can find my people here. They're all right here. Thank you, guys. But I come out, and it's like this sea of people. and I can't find my people. So being the astute alcoholic that I am, I decide I'll go sit by the front door. And when they leave, they'll find me. Okay, so I go and I sit there, and some guy comes up and he says, you want a drink? I'm like, sure. So he sits down and we talk and he buys me a drink, and nobody finds me. So I guess they didn't leave. But anyway, finally he says, you know, you're not going to find your friends. Do you want me to give you a ride home? And I'm like, yeah, that would be very nice. Would you give me a ride home? So I don't know if this ever happened to you, but did you ever drink inside and then get out in the fresh air? And I mean, you're like 20 times drunker than you were before you walked out the door. Well, that's kind of what happened to me. So this guy's trying to drive me home, and he's asking me for directions. I'm trying, you know. I'm giving it everything I got. And he's like, do you know where you live? And I'm getting really mad now because he's got no right to talk to me like that. You know, I really was trying. So anyway, he stops to go to the bathroom because we're driving around for a long time. And I can't find my house, though I was trying. And so he goes in to go to the bathroom, and I'm in that car, and I'm like, who does he think he's talking to like that? And I scoot right over in that brand new yellow Corvette, and I drive away, and I leave him in the bathroom. And he deserved it, right? So anyway, I don't get very far, and I pull up over a curb, and the police stop me. And they ask me whose car I'm in. I have a history of the police asking me whose car I'm in. And I don't know whose car I'm in. And so anyway, they take me to jail. But here's the thing. I had on a beautiful green suit that I had bought just for that St. Patrick's Day. And in my head, I'm thinking, they're going to know I'm not just a common drunk when they look at my suit. So anyway, they put me in a cell, never mentioned my suit, never said I looked nice. But anyway, I wake up in the morning, and they told me, you could have been released 4 hours ago, but we couldn't wake you up. So I get up and I walk out of that jail, and I am so humiliated. You know, I'm a nice girl. How is this happening to me? What am I doing in jail? And I get home and I vow, this is never going to happen to me again. I am never going to drink again. And this to me is the epitome of alcoholism. Later on that afternoon, I get a phone call from my friends that I couldn't find that night. And they said, what happened to you? Oh, I just went home. And they said, we're down the bar. You want to come? What do you think I did? I went. And I remember that horrible humiliation when I walked out of that jail that morning, the fear that someone would see me. But that wasn't, you know, that wasn't the end of my having the police stop me in cars. Another time I was driving someone's car, they were thinking of selling it. And so I was thinking of buying it. And so I wanted to take it for a test drive. You know, guys in bars are pretty loose with the girls, you know. So I said, let me take it for a ride. And so the guy says, okay. So he just gives me his car. So I take it for a ride, and I'm drunk. So I bang into the wall on the Southeast Expressway in Boston, practically total the car. But now I'm young and I'm cute, and this would never happen today. I don't care how young or how cute you are. But anyway, the cops stopped me, and you know, it used to really work if you cried a lot. You know, crying a lot could get you a long way, but not anymore. But it did back in the day. So I'm telling the police, oh, I'm so sorry, I can't believe this happened, blah, blah, blah. And then the cop says, well, whose car is this? Again, the same question. I have no clue. You know, I don't know why they keep asking me. So anyway, but you know what happened? They called me a cab, and they put me in a cab and sent me home and towed the car. Now, do you think that would happen today?
No.
So anyway, I had a lot of instances like that. My last drink was down in San Diego, California. I was at a conference at a beautiful resort, and I was with my roommate, and it was her company. And so she didn't have a boyfriend, so she invited me to go. So I went down, and I walked into the room, and all the tables, there were tablecloths and bottles of wine and all that. And this little voice in the back of my head said, Kathy, you know if you drink that, you're going to get drunk. And then this other little voice said, you'll drink slow. That's the voice. You know, that's the little voice that I listened to most of my life up to that point. Well, I did listen to it that night because I got very, very drunk. And I do remember my roommate coming up to me and saying, will you stop hitting on the president of my company, please? And I'm like, he thinks I'm cute. What are you talking about? And she's saying, it's the president. But anyway, picky. But anyway, I black out because I'm a blackout drinker. And I go to my room, I guess, and I wake up the next morning, and my roommate looks at me with such contempt. You know, and I'm already feeling a lot of contempt because it's a beautiful resort. They're out horseback riding, playing tennis and all that. And I'm sitting there trying to put the night together. What did I do once again? You know that horrible thing when you try to find out what you did without saying, I don't know. And you say things like, we really had a good time last night, huh? Or, how about, what time was it that you left? You know, just trying to put it all together. So she looked at me with contempt, and I got an attitude because I thought, well, you drink just as much as I do, you know? But at any rate, what I did was I left, and I drove back to L.A., and I was ashamed of myself, you know, because once again, I say humiliation is a big thing that got me here, because who feels good about that? You know, when you wake up in the morning, you don't know what you said, you don't know how you embarrass. I do know a couple of things I said, but I'm not going to tell you. But so I drove halfway back to L.A. from San Diego, and, you know, my last drink, this is such a stupid drink. My last drink was a strawberry daiquiri. Now, what respecting alcoholic would their last drink be a strawberry daiquiri? I mean, really? So I get back to L.A., and I call, he's kind of my boyfriend, just casual calls, no biggie. But anyway, I call him, and I say, because he was a drug counselor. He was also a drug addict, but still. He was a practicing drug addict and counselor. So anyway, I called him and I said, I think I have a problem. Do you think it's okay if I ask for help? And he said, not only do I think it's okay, I think it's a good idea. And of course, I got an attitude towards him. Well, who do you think you are? You're a drug addict. You know, there's a lot of snobbery about that kind of stuff. Not only if you're a drug addict or an alcoholic, it's what kind of drugs you're taking, what kind of drugs you're taking. Oh, yeah, he's just that and she's just that. It's so stupid. But anyway, I called central office, and they said to me, do you think you have a problem with alcohol? Which was fine, because if they had asked me if they thought I was an alcoholic, I would have said no. I did have a little problem with alcohol. So they start reading off these addresses of where I can go to meetings that night. Now, I've just come back from all the shame and humiliation, but I'm going to be very particular about where I go to a meeting, and I want to know what that address is. So anyone who knows California, I chose going to San Vicente Boulevard in Brentwood, which is a very exclusive area. But I could go to a meeting there. That'd be fine. So I get to my first meeting, and it's huge. There's like 300 people there. And they all save seats. Everyone gets there early, and they put their keys on the seat. I don't know this. You know, so I just walk over and I move someone's keys. No big deal. And this woman comes up to me and she said, "That's my seat." And in my head, I'm like, "I'm new." You know, they told me to tell you I was new. And so I expected some kind of preferential treatment. Well, I got to tell you, all these years later, I still don't like her. So, you know, my first resentment in AA, I was there 15 minutes. So, anyway, but you know, people come out, well, you know what they do in California? They make you stand up in your first 30 days. You know how they say anyone, this is your first meeting or all that? In California, they tell you to stand up and say, you know, your name, and you have to do that for 30 whole days. And you know, your heart's beating out of your chest, and but you know what's so nice is everyone comes up and talks to you at every meeting you go to. And I kind of wish we did that here, but no one's asked me to run AA here yet either. But anyway, it's nice. It'd be nice, you know. So anyway, I mean, to raise your hand, not to run AA. But so anyway, but my heart would be beating out of my chest and I'd be so scared. But people came up and they talked to me and they gave me their phone number. This one lady said, "Give me your phone number." So I gave her my phone number and she said, "I'll call you." And so all day, and she gave me her number, but all day I sat around waiting for her to call me. Like, when is she going to call? You know, I mean, I could have called her. But so finally, late in the day, she called. And so she said she'd meet me at a meeting and blah, 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 blah. So they told me, they didn't say 90 and 90 in those days. I think it's a great idea, but they didn't say that. You kind of just went along with everyone. You know, someone would give you their number and they'd say, "Well, I'll pick you up and I'll take you to a meeting or I'll meet you at the meeting." And then you'd go for coffee after the meeting. So they just, you know, the fellowship was huge for me getting sober because people just bring you in. And if you're new here tonight and people are trying to bring you in, let them. They don't want anything from you. You haven't got anything. But, you know, but they want to do this because they do, because somebody did it for them, and so they want to do it for you. So my advice would be let them. So she was my sponsor for a very brief amount of time because I just never called her. I didn't talk to her, but I did go to meetings. And then I went to a party. Somebody was having a 13-year birthday party. And I was flabbergasted because what could they possibly do at a party? You know, they didn't drink. What would they do? So I get to this party and I'm still paralyzed in fear, you know. I'm sober just a short period of time. And I'm sitting in the living room and I have my feet under the coffee table and I want to leave, but I'm frozen because I'm too scared to leave. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say to you. What's appropriate? What's inappropriate? Like, I'd wonder how long you were sober, but I would never ask in case that wasn't appropriate. So anyway, this real pretty lady comes over and she sits down on the floor beside me and she says, "You know, you can leave if you want to. In fact, I'll walk you to the door." And I was like, "Oh, thank you, God." Because all I really wanted to do was get out of there. I mean, they were all laughing and having fun and all that, but I wanted to get out of there. So she became my sponsor, and she really took me under her wing, and she took me to meetings all the time. And it wasn't like it is today where she made me literature chairperson. You know, your sponsor just said, "You're this." And you didn't have to have a group conscience and do all that. You just that. Yeah, no. She's making the coffee. I told her to. Or she's picking up the ashtrays. I told her to. That's just how it worked. So she made me literature chairperson. And I couldn't talk for myself. I was terrified. If we were at a discussion, I would go in the ladies' room if it was getting close to my part of the table because I didn't know what to say. And I was too afraid to say anything. And you all sounded so articulate. We were talking about that briefly tonight. you know, you'd listen to someone and they'd say, well, I had that situation happen and I did this and this is how I felt. And I was amazed that you knew how you thought and felt about stuff. And I thought, I am never going to get there. I am never going to be that way. So I would hide and try not to share. But I remember being about 4 months sober and I was walking behind my sponsor and we were going to the beach or something, and she was talking about me like I wasn't even there. She says, I know, right? So she says, yeah, this is my newcomer, Kathy. And I'm like, newcomer? I've got 4 months. Who is she talking about here? So anyway, I still just kept hanging out with her because she'd let me. And then I remember being at a meeting. I was about, I don't know, I wasn't six months, I must have been about 4 months. And so this lady hands me a note and she said, I'm sober 7 months and I'm still crazy, call me anytime. I'm like, why would I call you if you're still crazy after 7 months? You know, I mean, you should have arrived by then, in my opinion. But anyway, apparently she hadn't. So I never did call her. And then I turned a year, and my sponsor, I used to go to the Ohio Street meeting, and my sponsor, I always used to get lost. Oh, I still get lost sometimes, I know, Paul. But I always used to get lost. And so my sponsor's giving me my 1 year trip, and you know what she says to me? Because I got lost going to that meeting too. She says, I didn't know if you had permanent brain damage or if you were just incredibly stupid. Now, is that any way for a sponsor? I know, right? Yeah, that's how I felt. And so, but trust me, I didn't say a word. I went, ha ha ha. But anyway, we started the steps for me in California at that time were slow. You know, my sponsor thought that during the first year, the most you could hope for is that they didn't drink. That was the most, you know. You can't give them all these rules. Like, I remember one time I was giving some sponsee some rules, and my sponsor said, you're giving her the answers, and she doesn't even have the questions. You know, so we took our time. And the first step took me, you know, several months because I had to really take the first step. I can't just say I took the first step. I have to internalize that, and I have to know I'm an alcoholic. I personally think that's one of the reasons we keep saying I'm an alcoholic all the time, to reinforce that I'm an alcoholic and that I don't think like them. You know, and it used to bother me years ago. Bother me, did you hear that, Boston? But today it's okay, it's just how I'm wired, it's just how I think. I'm different, I'm okay with that. And so the second step was kind of difficult for me because it said, will restore us to sanity. Well, if you looked at me on the outside, I looked like I had everything really under control. You know, I had a good job, I had a nice home, I lived on the ocean, and you know, being in return us to sanity was just something that I couldn't buy into. And so she's telling me we have, you know, double personalities and all that. And then with all the sarcasm I could muster, I said, you mean like Sybil? And she said, yeah, like Sybil. And I was, whew, I wouldn't be like that. So we get to the third step, and you know, we do the typical thing, which I really love. Everyone still does it today. You know, I didn't know that I believed that God believed in me anymore. So she said, well, are you just willing to turn it over? And I was willing. I didn't know that it would work. I wasn't sure it would work. But I was willing and hoping that it would work. So we took the third step, and you know, we got down on our knees and said this third step prayer and all that. And then comes the biggie, right? The fourth step. You got to write that fourth step. And I was just about a year when we got to my fourth step. I tried to do it earlier, but I thought I was so bad that I couldn't look at myself. I just, you know, I've come to know that get us sober and we're pretty garden variety alcoholics. There's only so many bad things we can do anyway. You know, I mean, and they're all the same. We may have done them a little differently, but they're all the same, and they're all like the seven deadly sins, if you will. So anyway, I finally got through the fourth step, and I went to her house with directions. And she was a very meticulous woman, just dressed so nice and all that. So I get there and she's just kind of hang around the house, kind of clothes and no makeup and all that. And there's a box of Kleenex on the counter, and I'm thinking, well, that's a little much. You know, that's not going to happen. So we get through the fourth step, and at the end she said, "Is there anything else?" And I'm like, "Nope." And she said, "Are you sure?" "Yep." And she said, "Okay, I want to tell you something." And the thing, this is how God works for me in this program. The thing that I was holding back, that I was never going to tell anyone, including you guys, she said, "I did this." And it was like such a relief. It was like, oh my God, I'm not the only person. I'm not the worst person in the world. But the thing that was the best for me was when it was all over, and she hugged me and said, "I love you and I'll see you tomorrow." For me, that was the beginning of trust. That is the first time I trusted another human being, especially with my stuff. You know, I did try to go to a priest, by the way, and I asked him to listen to my fifth step, and he said, "No, that's his job, you know?" And he said, "No." And so I said, "Why?" And he said, "You should go to your sponsor, and your sponsor has probably done everything you've done. And if she hasn't, yeah, you put a little spice in her life." And I thought that was a lousy attitude for a priest, to tell you the truth. So, but with that said, to this day, I mean, people can do whatever they want. We're all going to do whatever we want anyway. No matter what your sponsor says, no matter what anyone else says, at the end of the day, we're going to do what we want. And we'll buy into what someone else says or not, but that's just my opinion. So I believe that anyone I'm sponsoring should do a fifth step with the sponsor. But that's just my opinion, as you said. Everything, unless it's written, is my opinion. So then I had the hardest time with 6 and 7. Character defects. I don't know what they are. I'm good. I mean, I'm really nice, and I give to people. Now, I keep a list of what you owe me, but I still do it. And I thought I was a good daughter. I thought I was a good mother. I thought I was a good friend. I thought I was a good employee. I just had a little problem. So anyway, but you know what'll happen? Those 6 and 7 steps will come barreling on you when you can't take it anymore. And you realize, I got to work through these character defects or I'm screwed. One thing I want to tell you, I was sober a couple of years and I was going to meet my sponsor at that San Vicente meeting. And this is how, you know, I don't know, I felt a lot of anger and rage at 2 years of sobriety. I mean, I could rip the head off a bear. I was so mad. So about everything. So I'm going to meet my sponsor. And you know how we are when we're driving. It just seems to, you know, do something to my mind. So I'm going to pull into this parking space, and this woman cuts me off and takes my parking space. Oh, I parked down the street, and I ran back as far as I could, as fast as I could, so I could catch her before she went wherever she was going. And you know, this is in Hillside. I'm just going to say it. I looked and screamed in her face, and I said, "You stole my fucking parking space!" And the poor little lady's like this. And I walked into my sponsor, and I said, "I may have just overreacted." Just a little. So Anyway, the anger in that second year was really, really hard. And I thought I was going to go crazy sometimes. I really know what they mean when they said say your blood boils. I have been that angry. And I was down in San Diego, and I was close to 5 years of sobriety, and I was telling my story. And I thought, I'm not angry anymore. Wow, what a gift. What a wonderful, wonderful gift. And with the eighth and ninth, you know, the family, of course, you make those amends. When I went to make amends, like to my mother, she, two different times. The first time, I'm so sorry. And I get there and she's watching some soap opera and she's saying, shh, wait a minute, Mary's about to have a baby. And I'm like, this is important stuff here. And then another time I realized how much grief I had given her. And I called her up and I said, you know, Mom, I'm so sorry. I'm just so sorry. And I broke down sobbing. And my mother's such a stoic Bostonian. She said, why don't you call me back when you get yourself together? So anyway, but I got through it. You know, I got through the eighth and ninth, and a boyfriend that I felt like I really used and took advantage of a lot, I called him. People are so gracious when we make our amends. At least that's been my experience. I think people basically want to forgive us, you know, because people are nice. So I called him up and I said, you know, I'm so sorry. I've done this, and this. And he said, you're just Crazy Kathy from Cambridge. You know, like all of my behavior is just because I'm Crazy Kathy from Cambridge. So the 10th, of course, we keep on doing that all the time. And the 11th has always been one of my favorite steps because I just love when I have that conscious contact with God. For me, God initially was the Pacific Ocean. Sometimes it depends on where I lived. But when I was out west, it was the Pacific. And I would run every morning there and I would talk to the ocean because even though I didn't know, I had moved, but God hadn't moved, but I had moved. But I knew the Pacific Ocean was more powerful than me. And I think that's why, you know, a lot of people get aggravated when they say stuff like, oh, it could be a doorknob. Well, they don't mean that literally. They mean that as long as you have something that's more powerful than yourself, which to me at that time was the Pacific Ocean. And then when I was in Boston, it was the Atlantic Ocean. Then I moved to Denver. There's no ocean. So, but they told me that they would let me use the mountain guard while I was there. But anyway, today, you know, it's been a lot of my life lived sober. And my life is huge. I have raised two families. And I met Paul in this program. My company transferred me back to Boston. And I went to a meeting and Paul was there. And he was selling raffle tickets. You know, the only way you can win a big book in Boston is if you buy a raffle ticket. And he was running around selling raffle tickets. And I'm telling on myself, and I don't advocate this. Paul and I have been married going on 32 years, but I was in therapy and I wanted a more serious relationship. And so I prayed for Paul. I didn't know it was Paul, but I prayed for someone that would be someone I could hang with and have fun with, and I was looking for someone to ski with, and I met Paul. And so he's walking around with all these, what do you call them? Tickets, little tickets hanging, trying to sell his little tickets. And so I said to my girlfriend, she's sitting beside me, and I said, do you think he's new? And she said, very. So anyway, there was, I knew I really liked him, and so we became friends, and we skied together, and we had long conversations on the phone, and, you know, we would go to dances, and he would call and say, because there were a lot of dances then, he'd say, are you going to that dance, you know, and I don't know, maybe we danced a little too close, a little, you know, for a newcomer. I should know better. But But anyway, and I got to tell one story on him, and then I'm going to quit. But he was at my house, and we were watching TV one time. And this is very personal. But anyway, I just love it because, you know, he's a guy, and the girls are really like this, too. So we're lying there on my bed watching the show, and so he said, do you want me to spend the night? And I said, no, I don't think so, not yet. He said, me either. It's too early. What a liar. So anyway, I've been blessed to have this wonderful man in my life. We're going on 32 years married now. And so it was the right thing for me. You know, we've raised two families together. And now we have these wonderful grandchildren. And my whole life today is only, and you know, everyone says this, but I mean this with all my heart, is due to you people, because I didn't know who I was. I learned who I was by listening to you tell me who you were. And I could identify. You know, they told me, just identify. Don't look for the differences. Just look for the things that person's talking about that you can identify with. And so little by little, I learned that you were afraid. You were just as afraid as I was. But you know what? I'm really not afraid today. And if anything happens, I have a solution. And it's right in this room. And I got to tell you, I owe my whole life to Alcoholics Anonymous and to you people. And thank you for asking me to share.